Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion of healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions either by phone or by email, all here in the next hour on Ask Dr. Dawn. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers. They are not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, I have remembered to tell you that it is Alzheimer's National Memory Screening Day, and we have on the line here Eric Hall, the CEO of the Alzheimer's Foundation of America.
Hi, how are you?
How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for having us today.
Well, I am very happy to have you. Please tell us about National Memory Screening Day.
Sure. The Alzheimer's Foundation of America, in well over 2,200 sites across the United States, on this upcoming Tuesday, November 17th, will be offering National Memory Screening Day. Memory Screening Day allows individuals who have issues and concerns about their memories to go in and speak with a healthcare professional to gain some information and insight, and if they'd like, to participate in a free confidential memory screening. A memory screening is generally a 5 to 7 minute question and answer session, at the end of which there's no diagnosis, but there is rather a capture of an indication as to whether proper diagnosis and follow-up with your doctor should take place. And so the day last year saw well over 50,000 people throughout the country screened, and hundreds of thousands going to sites to get information about memory problems, about Alzheimer's disease, about care, and most importantly, too, about successful aging.
Well, I checked your very nice website. Toll-free number is 866-AFA-8484, and there's also Well, I don't have the website address.
Website is www.nationalmemoryscreening.org. And on that site, individuals can go to an actual map of the United States, pull up wherever they might be, and it'll give them indications as to what is available and who is offering National Memory Screening Day in their area.
Now, just for example, I punched in my zip code 95076, and the two local sites are the Kmart Pharmacy in Freedom and Aegis of Aptos, which is an assisted living facility. Now, I have a question for you that comes up all the time in my practice, which is no news is good news. So one of the things that we encounter as physicians is complaints and concerns coming from the middle-aged children of people who are starting to show signs of mental or cognitive dysfunction. And those individuals tend to be in denial and, for the most part, are not really wanting to know or confront the issues because that would require change. And of course, one of the things when you start to develop cognitive deficits that you hate is change. So what would be a good answer to the people who say, I don't really want to know about this. I'm not going to go take a test that I might fail.
Sure, I understand completely. First, let's explain exactly what this is. Though the Alzheimer's Foundation of America is offering National Memory Screening Day, please realize that we're not looking just for Alzheimer's disease or indications of Alzheimer's disease. This is not in any way, shape, or form a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or any other cause. And basically, it comes out of this sense. If you ask anyone on the street what exactly is the most common manifestation of Alzheimer's disease, they're going to say memory problems. They're going to say forgetfulness. What we all need to come to realize and gain knowledge about is that memory problems in and of themselves does not necessarily mean that you have Alzheimer's disease. Memory problems can be related to a number of different causes, some of which are actually reversible causes, such as vitamin D deficiency, thyroid issues, even some of the prescription drugs that we might be taking now, the combination of them might actually be causing some memory problems. And so National Memory Screening Day is not about Alzheimer's disease as much as it is about memory problems. And listen, we're absolutely, as a nation, terrified of this disease. We know, all of us know, that there is no cure. Let me just point out here, though, that the hope behind this disease really lies in the hundreds and thousands of researchers across the world, many of which I've had the opportunity of speaking with, who are actually probably the most compassionate, passionate individuals that I have met, and probably some of the greatest minds on the face of our planet. So I'm convinced that within a period of time, we will end up with either a cocktail mixture of treatments that will offset the progression of the symptoms of the disease, like presently the AIDS virus enjoys, or we might actually become very lucky and actually come across a cure for Alzheimer's disease. What people need to realize with Alzheimer's is that if it is a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, if you go to a doctor and they eliminate every other cause and probable cause, and there are lots of causes that need to be eliminated before we end up with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, if that is the case, what happens then is an individual has the ability to be placed on treatments. The treatments that are available right now for Alzheimer's, regrettably, are not a cure, but what they are able to do is offset the progression of the symptoms of the disease. What does that really equate? It allows the individual diagnosed to actually enjoy a higher quality of life for a longer period of time. And listen, nobody's comfortable with that. You and I are very common, our experiences. We go to a doctor like yourself, Doc, and we are given a prescription and we get better. Regrettably, Alzheimer's doesn't have that, but what it does allow is for an individual to enjoy the highest quality of life for the longest period of time. And right now, that's what is precious. That's what needs to be preserved. Additionally, another part to all this is that the care related to Alzheimer's, the issues, the financial issues, the legal issues related to a diagnosis of Alzheimer's are really quite in-depth, and there's a lot to be considered. And our experience at the Alzheimer's Foundation of America is that when a family actually has enough time to actually plan, when they have enough time to learn as much as they can learn about what this disease is, I firmly believe that there's nothing in our life that has taught us how to properly care for an individual with Alzheimer's. It really does come down to knowledge, and knowledge, therefore, is empowerment. The time that would be allotted to a family to make proper plans, to know what's happening, to understand the manifestations and how this disease might progress, is really important because caregivers need to be able to have time to actually plan for that. Our experience at the Alzheimer's Foundation of America is that people calling us, generally the disease is already 4 to 6 years progressed. They took their loved one to a doctor because the manifestations and the safety issues and the impact of their loved one's difficulties on their everyday activities became so problematic that they finally took them to a doctor. What we as a nation need to really become is much more sensitive to our own memory issues and our cognitive issues. If you and I have a pain in our arm, we know to go to a doctor. If we, you and I have a pain or difficulty anywhere, we know how to discuss this with our doctor. The problem with memory problems, and therefore the problem with Alzheimer's and why it is so late in being diagnosed, is that we don't know how to discuss this with our doctor. And so part of National Memory Screening Day is, if you are screened by the healthcare professional, you are explained about what this might mean and what it might not mean. It's definitely not a diagnosis, but there is encouragement now that you've been proactive to come here to be screened. Please be proactive now and go to talk to your doctor.
Mr. Hall, I'm going to stop you right there and just say that the passion and enthusiasm that you feel for the topic is very manifest. And great. I want to thank you for taking this time to talk with us. We will be posting on the website a link to your website and information about National Memory Screening Day. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Bye. We've been talking to Eric Hall, CEO of the Alzheimer's Foundation of America. We had a lot of very interesting emails. The first one that I have here comes from Kelly in Portland, Oregon. Kelly's a loyal podcast listener, and her story is follows. Last year, my sister was diagnosed with contralateral breast cancer at the age of 47 and tested positive for the BRCA2 gene. I also tested positive for this gene, and since my odds of breast cancer were so high, I had a prophylactic double mastectomy. I recently completed reconstruction. I'm 42 years old and in very good health now that I've recovered from the surgery. My father died at 76 of cancer after having stomach cancer in his 60s and prostate cancer in his 70s. My mother has not been tested for BRCA, but she's 77 and has not had cancer. We have no other known family history of breast or ovarian cancer, so I have three questions for you. Because of the gene, I think my odds of ovarian cancer climb to about 1 to 2% as I approach age 50. I have three children under age of 14, so my tolerance for risk is low. I'm thinking about having an oophorectomy, that's having your ovaries removed, next year. Are you aware of other factors I should consider in timing the decision I'm finished having kids? And when I eventually get the ovaries out, should I have my uterus removed? And when I do have my ovaries removed, I'm wondering about my options for hormone replacement therapy. My odds of breast cancer are now lower than the general population, but they're not zero, so what would you recommend for me? Parenthetically, I'm also a little disappointed with some sources of information, even some physicians, who don't seem to differentiate between BRCA1 and BRCA2. A lot of the advice, often conflicting, for what to do seems like philosophical positions and not founded on research. I hope you can use your medical genius to help me with this. Well, medical genius aside, let's talk about this philosophical position first. I would agree with you that what you are listening to when people discuss BRCA1 and BRCA2 is in fact philosophical positions, because that statement, BRCA1 or BRCA2, is not a binary statement. We know that there are lots of different places in those genes where mutations can occur. And so it's not just that you have a mutation in that gene, it's what mutation do you have? And some of the mutations may not be as bad as others. Furthermore, there are other mutations on other genes for breast cancer that we haven't identified. So you don't necessarily reduce all of your risk by identifying that you don't have BRCA1 or 2. This makes it all very complicated. And so, yeah, when you have a complicated system where not all facts are known, philosophy does enter in. You want a nice, standard, scientifically based piece of binary do or don't do advice. And unfortunately, that isn't available and probably will never be available in your lifetime or mine. Now, regarding your decision about having your ovaries removed for a 1% or 2% risk, that in and of itself is a philosophical decision, but you've already made that decision, so I'm not going to meta comment on it. As far as the practical aspects, I would get a bone scan before I had my ovaries removed. And I would definitely think about doing raloxifene or tamoxifen, which are SERMs, selective estrogen receptor modulators, which will do two things. One of which is, while they won't help you with hot flashes and perimenopausal symptoms, in fact, they may aggravate them, they will protect your breasts from the effects of the residual estrogen that's being produced in your body, and they will protect your bones. And the bones are the things I'm really focusing on, because by having your ovaries removed surgically, you are putting your body through a terrible shock. And one of the things that will happen over the next 2 or 3 years is that you'll lose bone mass, possibly as much as 2 to 3% a year. So you need to be aware of that. Another aspect to putting your body through that kind of shock is its effect on your lipids, which may or may not go up depending on your associated genetics, and your libido. So I would say counseling, being in marriage counseling as you go through what is going to be a very rocky road, would be an important preventative, proactive factor to be thinking about, because you want, if you have a solid marriage, you'd like to keep it that way. And when you start doing things like removing both breasts and radically altering your body, and now you're going to radically alter your libido with removing your ovaries, those things need to be thought of ahead of time. With respect to should you do hormone therapy, it seems to me that you are a candidate for estrogen replacement therapy for symptoms, at least for the short term, but you still have breast tissue. So do be aware that your risk as far as breast cancer is less than the general population now that you've had both breast removes. But if, since you do carry this mutation, you have a small amount of mutated breast tissue that remains in your body and is subject to stimulation by estrogen. So you need to be careful. And that's why I'm saying Evista for your bones, and maybe just deal with the hot flashes with some of the other non-hormonal means. As far as having your uterus removed, I'm giving you a big thumbs down on having your uterus removed. The uterus, even after menopause, serves some important structural functioning. And as we get back to the libido issue, in some people, the nerves go all the way up to the cervix. So if you remove the cervix, you actually affect the sensation in the vagina. And after all that you are planning on giving up, that would be a pretty big takeaway. So I would discourage you from doing that. So a very loaded, double-barreled question from Kelly, and I hope I've been helpful. One more email before we go to the phones. This is from Jessica in Florida. My boyfriend has a pain in the left lower side of his abdomen. He's had this pain for 2 years. He's had colonoscopies, endoscopies, and several CT scans, but the doctors can't seem to find anything. He's usually pretty regular, but sometimes finds blood in his bowel movements. If you push on his side under his rib cage on the left, you feel a clicking. It feels like the top of a jar. I'd love your help in trying to suggest anything to try, or if you've heard of this before. He's been told by different doctors he has irritable bowel syndrome, stomach acid, floating rib. He's miserable, and frankly, I'm starting to feel his pain. Well, Jessica, pain falls into two categories. It's either going to be structural or functional. Structural pain, such as a cancer, a polyp, a stricture, you've pretty much ruled out with your colonoscopies. And you've also pretty much ruled out active colitis or inflammatory bowel disease with a colonoscopy. So those things are off the table for the purposes of the discussion. The other source of pain is functional. That's where history comes in. Things like the timing of the pain, the provocation of the pain. Is the pain worse when he has the rectal bleeding, or is there no association? And we have functional testing for these sorts of abdominal pains. Another thing to be considered is whether this could be referred pain from perhaps his low back or a pinched nerve. And that, again, you'd look at whether or not certain positions aggravate the pain to give you a clue in that direction. If he were to come to me in my functional medicine practice, I would probably get a test of his bowel flora and also look at the possibility that he could have a food allergy of some kind, a food sensitivity, perhaps a gluten sensitivity, perhaps an inability to absorb certain carbohydrates, perhaps a maldigestion function. So I would look at these functional things, and we can take a look at the stool and test it for bacteria. We can test it for the output. In other words, is he breaking down into waste products what needs to be broken down? You could identify perhaps some of the functional barriers. And so that's where I would go next, is looking at perhaps an elimination diet and perhaps some functional testing. I don't want to try to practice medicine over the radio. That's considered bad form. So these are general recommendations, but I hope that at least this will get you started. My suggestion would be to look for a functional medicine physician. You can go to the Institute for Functional Medicine. Just Google that and look for a physician near you who has that kind of training. Many naturopathic doctors who are in the phone book as NDs, not MDs, will also understand how to evaluate this sort of problem and are happy to do it after important and life-threatening structural issues have been eliminated. Hope that helps. Let's go to Judith in Santa Cruz. Hello, Judith, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
Well, it's the saga of naproxen and Prilosec again. It's been 20 years at least since I've been on that regime, and I hated it, but I knew nothing else. Well, so I had a session of real extreme stomach cramps, and it was centered up near in the stomach this time. I had an endoscopy. And to prepare for the endoscopy, she changed my meds and put me on Celebrex and something new that nobody knows anything about called Capidex.
Can you
Dex Lansoprazole delayed release capsules.
Right, okay.
And she said it was not a proton pump inhibitor. It worked in a different way.
Hmm, okay.
Well, the combination of the two worked marvelously, and by the time I got into the endoscopy, there were signs of healing of two or three little spots in my stomach.
In your stomach, not in your esophagus.
in my up near the entrance,
okay,
or the exit of the esophagus, and two in the stomach.
All right, very good.
And it's been working wonderfully. My stomach is in great shape. However, my formulary for the next year has no Capidex, and I would have to make special arrangements, and whether or not I could afford that drug, I don't know.
Well, let me stop you for a second right there.
Do.
Okay. Why don't you want to take proton pump inhibitors, Protonix or Nexium?
Well, it's not that I don't want to. It's that my digestion has always been questionable.
Okay, no. I'm asking specifically, why are we going to this new drug, which, by the way, I don't think is any different from a proton pump inhibitor in the long run? My understanding, and I'll double check and retract it next week if I'm mistaken, is that this is a prodrug. It's converted in your body, basically by your liver, to a proton pump inhibitor. That makes it take longer to convert, so you get an evener blood level. But I don't believe that it's fundamentally different from a proton pump inhibitor. I think it's the new and improved proton pump inhibitor that they get another 17 years on their patent for. So I am not understanding why you would need this drug, except for the fact that your doctor has a stack of it on her shelf right
exactly.
now, because the company is selling it and they want people to use it. But I'm not seeing any reason that this is better than going out to, you know, Costco or, you know, your discount drugstore and buying a stack load of Prilosec. You know, so that's my reason for asking you, why do you not want to take a proton pump inhibitor?
Well, because my digestive system is so out of whack under...
Right, but you're going to be out of whack with this other drug as well.
Okay.
So there's no... This is not in my view... different. I will retract that if I'm mistaken, but I don't think that there's any implication that's different for your digestive tract.
Okay, that's a comfort, because I can't afford it anyway.
No, it's a ripoff.
And how about the Celebrex? She seemed to feel that the original panic about Celebrex isn't merited and that it's worth prescribing it.
Okay, well, it depends on how long you're going to be taking it for. Do you have some kind of arthritis pain, and that's why?
Forever.
Okay. So when you take Celebrex for arthritis pain, for the first 6 months, there's a decreased risk of GI bleeding. At 12 months, that benefit starts to go away. And by a year and a half on Celebrex, the GI bleeding risk is identical to if you were taking ibuprofen. This 18-month data was suppressed by the company when it submitted its drug approval information to the FDA. They took the study out to 18 months, but they didn't submit that data because that data would have made that drug no better than ibuprofen in the long run for prevention of GI bleeding, which was the whole reason that they sold COX-2 inhibitors to the population, was it was supposed to be safer. Trouble is, if you're taking it over the long run, it's not safer. I don't, in the long run, consider Celebrex to be any safer than ibuprofen.
How about the naproxen that I've been taking?
Nope. They're all basically the same risk.
So go back to the good old ones.
Well, you know, they're cheap. If you're not getting a benefit in terms of complications, exactly what benefit are you getting? I mean, I understand you need something for your pain. I would be trying to push you over to natural anti-inflammatories like Zyflamin, Boswellia, possibly that hops derivative. They're over-the-counter anti-inflammatories you should be thinking about. There's high-dose fish oil that you should be thinking about. And then what I do on top of that is I give people Tylenol with codeine or Vicodin for pain, because I'd rather make them constipated as a GI side effect than give them a GI bleed. Over 40,000 people a year are hospitalized in this country for life-threatening gastrointestinal bleeds, and some of them actually die as a result of taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. So the risk-benefit profile doesn't favor the use of Celebrex or ibuprofen. The quality of life profile always trumps the risk-benefit profile, and treatment needs to be individualized. But maybe you could be managed by anti-inflammatories that didn't increase your risk of bleeding and pain pills that didn't increase your risk of bleeding, as opposed to the non-steroidals.
Mm-hmm. That's a comfort, because I'm about to run out of samples and I've got to do something. So I think I'll just go back to the naproxen and the Prilosec and grit my teeth.
Well, in the long run, I think that you should go back to your doctor and say what I've just said and say, in the long run, is the difference between taking Celebrex and Protonix after 2 years. You know, can you show me any evidence that that's better than taking Celebrex and Capidex and spending, you know, $200 a month? So that's, you know, $3,000 over 2 years. You know, am I actually buying anything with that $3,000 in terms of safety?
Great.
Okay, good luck to you.
Just what I wanted to hear.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have a question live in the studio. Good morning. And Lyle Troxell, the chairman of the board of GeekSpeak, is here to dazzle me with his geekiness.
Well, except that I'm not going to be geeky and tell you stuff about technology. I'm going to ask a medical question. And I get a lot of people throughout the week coming to me, as probably you do, about our shows and asking us questions related. So this week, someone was talking about their knee, and it's an 11-year-old girl, and her knee has been hurting for about 2 weeks. She's a dancer, a ballet dancer, and pretty active. And she needed ibuprofen the other night and took some. And I just thought, well, it'd be nice to talk. So I talked to her parents. And thing is, medical insurance is covering about 50% of their bill or something like that. And it's a deterrent from going in. And it's a knee injury. Is it a problem? And so I thought I'd ask you.
Okay. First of all, an 11-year-old, are we talking ballet dancing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm worried about the growth plate on the front of her tibia where her quadriceps attach.
Right.
And there is a condition you can look up called Osgood-Schlatter's. It's in kids who play volleyball, who jump a lot. And at 11, she has a cartilage glue, a cartilage plate between where her quadriceps attach and her tibia. And if you yank on that enough, you get microfractures. It's totally weak. It's not even really bone yet. It's still kind of malleable, like epoxy that hasn't quite set.
Okay.
So you want to consider the possibility that the activity is creating problems. The treatment for that is stretching, because at that age, their bones grow faster than their muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're doing muscle strengthening and they're not doing adequate stretching, they can definitely get this condition. Ibuprofen per se is not dangerous if it's taken in short doses for, say, under 2 weeks for the treatment of an acute problem. I think it's a great drug. It's the long-term use of it that screws up the stomach mucus, that eliminates the protective mucus, and really creates the issues.
Okay, and would that effect show up as a feeling in the knee?
Yes, it
would. Around the kneecap?
Right.
Okay.
And so there's quote-unquote growing pains, which mm-hmm. are also in the knee and very common at that age. And again, it's related to the fact that you're undergoing a dramatic leg lengthening at that time.
Right.
You know, leg under construction. And when things are under construction, they aren't quite as stable or as strong. And then when they're subjected to stressors, they tend to talk to you.
Right.
And then there's a political aspect of it, which is, you know, you have health insurance with a high copay. It's going to discourage you from going to the doctor unless you're really sick. And that's nuts. We have something that's a small problem that would be easily fixed with a little bit of medical advice and maybe some icing and decreasing activity, maybe turns into a bigger issue. And people who have Osgood-Schlatter's will have a visible malformation of their leg for the rest of their life. Their knee will look funny. And it will always look funny. And, you know, that's a cosmetic issue for a pretty young girl that, you know, how young women obsess on, you know, my toenails are too short.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a big lump on the front of your knee is definitely something that you're going to obsess about.
Would that start showing up as a physical manifestation now?
Well, it'll take a while.
It will.
It will take a while. And by the time it shows up, it's too late to reverse.
So it sounds like a situation where you might want to, she might want to kind of suck it up and go in to see a doctor and make sure that this is the case. And
I think she needs a knee x-ray.
Yeah,
and I would definitely say negotiate the price of the knee x-ray ahead of time
mm-hmm.
and get it down to a reasonable price. You might even decide that it's better to pay cash and then submit that to your insurance company, because then you get credit towards your copay.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of little games that people who have inadequate health insurance should be trying to play. The system is gameable. Believe me, it's being gamed by the other side.
Right. And I assume that this would be, if someone had a knee that was kind of hurt for a day, no big deal, and it goes away. But at what period do you think it's something you should be seeing a doctor?
Well, if you have pain at rest that uh-huh. persists for more than a day, if you have pain with normal activity, so I guess the story I would give it, if you go and you exercise and do your dance class and your knee hurts that night, and you wake up and take an ibuprofen, and then the next day you're fine and you're running around at PE and not having any problems, I'm not so worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
But if the knee pain is persisting for 3-5 days after extreme activity or after the stressor,
mm-hmm.
if there's waking up at night with the pain. The other thing you have to consider, and this is a scary thought, is bone cancer. Kids get bone cancer and they get it at the knee.
Okay, well, that's horrifying.
Yes, it is, and I'm not trying to freak you or your friend out. So that's where the night pain and the persistent pain starts ringing bells in my head, though.
Right.
So what are the odds that this is an Ewing sarcoma? Really, really low. What are the odds that somebody in this country is going to die because their sarcoma didn't get identified, because they didn't get taken in for an X-ray, because their parents didn't want to pay the copay? It's not zero, and that is absolutely, I can't even, reprehensible, that's not even the word that I'm looking for. Astonishing, disgusting, completely decadent. I'm still searching. I'm out. I can't find the word for this. The idea is just horrible to me.
Right.
That anybody should die unnecessarily for lack of health insurance, but particularly children.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, Don, very much for that.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's talk to Jim in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jim, and welcome to the program.
Yes. Good morning, Dr. Don.
Hello.
Criminal is a good word that comes to mind in relation to the topic you were just speaking of, people who can't afford to copay to get proper medical care.
Criminal's good. I like that one.
Yes. I'm not calling you about that, though. I'm calling you about your topic today, which was the Alzheimer's awareness.
Uh-huh.
I'm going through that myself right now with my father. He's 85 years old. He's been in sort of an Alzheimer's dementia prognosis for about 6 years. And I think one of the things I want to mention on your show is that people who have Alzheimer's are not the only ones who are affected by this. It's
a
tremendously devastating disease for family who are in a situation where they watch someone that they're close to going through a gradual decay of their mind and eventually their body. And it's a disease that, unlike cancer, where you can say, yes, there's an end point because you know the body is being overridden by this invasion of cancer cells, with dementia, it's a process that seems like the end point is really unfathomable until the body just completely collapses because it no longer functions. And it's easy to sort of try to rationalize when you have an elderly parent or somebody you know, and they're saying, man, I'm starting to lose it, because they get early warning signs that they're not forgetting things, or they are forgetting things, or they're incapable of doing the normal activities that they were before. And I have a direct experience of that myself with my father. I remember having conversations with him, and he'd say, man, I'm starting to lose it. And I'd say, oh, we all are, because X, Y, Z, age and everything else. But in hindsight, I realized that it was an early warning call.
Yes.
And I missed it. And I think a lot of people in the family missed it, too.
Jim, do you have long-term care insurance for yourself?
Do I?
Yes.
I've been self-employed all my life, and I'm 63 years old now. My insurance premiums are just staggering.
But I didn't ask about health insurance. I asked about long-term care insurance, which is completely separate.
No.
Okay. The time to purchase that, if you decide to purchase it, certainly look into it.
Okay.
But the time to purchase it is now.
Right.
For you.
Okay.
Because your family may, statistically speaking, eventually face this with you, your children. And so if you can learn from the experience of the devastation and the impact that your father's illness has had, and try not to perpetuate that into the next generation, that will have put some positive meaning on your father's experience and your experience with your father. So I always try to say, where's the healing in a situation? And that's one place where at least you can take what you've learned and pass that on. And it will be possible for you to get long-term care insurance. It's fairly competitive right now.
I see.
The other thing, if you decide not to purchase it because the price is too high, is to do some planning in terms of getting yourself, first of all, tested for the APOE4 gene and finding out if you're monozygous or heterozygous, whether you have that. That testing is widely available. Pay for it. Don't let it get into your medical record. Just buy it. Go to your doctor and have them order it, but then pay for it yourself so that there's no paper trail.
Right, okay. Because
even though supposedly there is a bill that passed last year that was supposed to prevent discrimination by insurance companies on the basis of genetic testing, there is actually a bill making its way through Congress. I am so confident that Congress is going to take that legislative language and turn it into something that's protective for people, that I'm still telling people, pay for your own genetic testing.
Okay.
Because until it goes to the Supreme Court, we have no idea what this legislation is going to mean. and you don't want to create a situation for yourself, but you do need to know this.
Right.
Okay, so I believe with the reason that we put Eric Hall on today is that I believe forewarned is forearmed. And if a person has little problem with remembering phone numbers, I'm not so worried about them. But if they have problems that will come up on the type of testing that the Alzheimer's Foundation is out there doing, if they have those sorts of memory problems, then yes, I want them coming into my office because I want to do a dementia workup. I want to just describe a situation I had in my own household, which was that my mother was getting very forgetful. She was falling. We all kind of took a look at each other and said, oh my goodness, what's happening here? And the result was we got some testing done and we took her off some of her medications. We took her off everything that could have a central nervous system effect. And one of them was a drug that she was taking that was a lifestyle drug, effectively. It wasn't critical for her survival. It made her more comfortable, but it was also making her nuts. It was causing her cognitive function to deteriorate.
Oh, right. You know, you've mentioned this before in the past, this thing of the toxic chemical soups that we get stuck with from time to time.
So we have to take people off their drugs. We have to get a little brave about that, take people off their meds, certainly inform them, yes, you know, you could get sick, your blood pressure may go up, whatever, but we need to find out if this is making you nuts.
Right.
If it's affecting your memory. And we have our elders on too many drugs, and we're afraid to stop them. I'm afraid to stop drugs because I'm afraid of being blamed when the person deteriorates. And
sure.
it's like, I won't be blamed for giving them another drug, but I'll be blamed for taking a drug away. It's nuts. It defies logic. So,
well, this was a conversation that I had with my father many times because he had had a valve replaced in his heart many years ago, and he was on Coumadin regimes. And there were 18 different drugs that were going into his body before he finally got to the point where he lost complete mental facilities.
The interesting thing is when you have someone who's, let's say, got end stage or close to end stage Alzheimer's, and you put them into a care facility and you pull all of those drugs because now you feel sort of safe. Also, you're not really trying to prolong life anymore.
They get better.
They often do, at least a little bit. And certainly they get peppier.
Yeah, well, what's happening with my father right now is that the Alzheimer's progressed to the point where he's lost all bodily functions. He's just laying there in bed, and he's not able to communicate. He has eye movement. He's on oxygen 24 hours a day.
Exactly. He's reverted to the state mentally of an infant or less.
Right.
And I hope that he has a no-code order, and I hope that you're not doing feedings.
That's one of the reasons why I'm calling, is because he would not do that prior to this.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has left a medical directive, leaving my stepmother in charge of his care. She has her own reasons for not letting him go, you know, because right now it's the most important thing that she's doing with her life, and if he dies, she loses the reason for continuing.
There can also be financial factors in terms of pension incomes and things like that that it affects this sort of a decision.
Well, I understand that, but in some ways it's kind of grotesque to see someone who should be dead, to be quite honest, in other times and other situations without the kind of medical intervention that has happened for him. He probably would have died mercifully from some other cause.
And you know, when they were talking a couple weeks ago about death committees, this is an individual where you have to ask yourself, is it rational to do any sort of life prolongation? Is it really rational? And as a society, we've left that question. We've made the decision to leave that to the family and to the designated hitter.
Mm-hmm.
And like it or not, she's the designated hitter.
That's right.
And that's how it is. It's kind of like it or lump it, unfortunately. And I'm not trying to be harsh. I sympathize with you.
Right.
And the pain that you feel seeing your father.
Sure. So my encouragement to anybody who's listening is to sit down and have these hard, heart-to-heart conversations before it gets to the point where the person who's affected by it does not have the ability to choose anymore.
You know, my attitude is Thanksgiving is coming. Families are going to gather. And what I want to encourage everyone to do around the Thanksgiving dinner table this year, anyone who's listening, get out your pencil and make a to-do list for yourself. And to-do list number one is you want as thorough a family history as you can get. Aunt Floyd had breast cancer when she was 22 or whatever, but you want to know as much about your family history in terms of what diseases did people get and what did they die of, because this information is It's volatile. It's going to die off, and it won't be recapturable. Mm-hmm. And so data mining your older relatives for that information now and writing it down, this will become extremely useful information in the next 5 to 10 years, because it will direct how we do certain kinds of testing. The testing is coming off the assembly line right now, but we can't apply it to the entire population. It wouldn't make sense to do that. But applying it selectively to people with a family history is going to make a lot of sense. So go out and family history gather. Second thing is, anybody who rides a motorcycle or engages in rock climbing, skydiving, I don't care if they're 22, and anyone over the age of 40 needs a living will, a five wishes, a durable power of attorney. I know that this is kind of a crazy idea, and so I'll just throw it out there, but why not have a living will party? Everybody sits down, and they can just answer the following questions. You are going to be in a hospital bed paralyzed for the rest of your life with minimal cognitive functioning. Vent, no vent. Do you want to be allowed to die? Do you want to be kept alive if you're going to be very disabled? If I knew that, if I knew what people thought about that when they were 22, and maybe they just are like, you know, forget it, I'm out of here. And that's
sure, and vulnerable.
That's fine. I'd like to know that. Our default is to keep everybody alive, because you're going to make one mistake or the other. You want to keep people alive when they would want to be dead, rather than making people dead when they would want to be alive.
Right.
You know, if those are your two choices and you're, you know, you vow to do no harm, then you go with the harm in the direction of living.
Mm-hmm. If you get those, you know, those people who are listening and they get that form signed, be sure they get two witnesses to sign it so that it becomes a legal document. It's not just something that somebody pulls out of their pocket and said, my dad wrote this.
Yeah, there's actually something called Five Wishes, which is fivewishes.com, I think, or something. You can Google it. I'll have a link on my website since I've mentioned it. And this form is quite a bit easier to get witnessed.
Okay.
And that's at least in California.
Well, Dr. Don, I'm going to let you go. There's probably other people waiting. I just want to let you know that I think you're one of the most compassionate medical voices that I've heard in a long time, and I listen to your program whenever I can. I thank you for being there.
Well, thank you very much. Bye-bye. And let's take Alyssa in Santa Cruz.
Thanks, Dr. Don. It's Alyssa, actually.
Excuse me.
No problem. So I got a flu shot at the beginning of October, you know, because I thought it's good for people to get flu shots in general, keep things from spreading around. And I got it at a pharmacy, not at the doctor's office.
Is this H1N1 or seasonal flu?
No, just the seasonal flu.
Seasonal flu. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
I'm not eligible for the H1N1. I'm 32, so I'm not really at risk for either. But I often get a flu shot, so I don't get the flu because I hate getting the flu. I'm healthy otherwise. So I go to the pharmacy to get my flu shot. And when the pharmacist gives me the shot, he says, oops, there's the bone. And I felt this horrible pain. And then it subsided a bit, and I thought it was going to be, you know, like it says on the little info sheet, you may have injection site pain for 3 or 4 days. But then it continued to hurt in the muscle of my shoulder. I continued to have pain for a few weeks. I mean, it wasn't horrible, but I took ibuprofen for it a couple of times. And
did it hurt when you used the muscle?
Yes.
So when you brought your arm up to the side to comb your hair would be...
Exactly.
Okay.
What I noticed it the most would be when I would be getting dressed.
Gotcha. Okay.
Or undressed. So it has, the pain has tapered off, but I still sort of notice it from time to time, usually just when I'm exercising or something like that. But this is now a long time, and I'm wondering, should I see a doctor about it?
Well, first,
you know, what are they even going to do? What's going on in there anyway?
They're going to wait for it to get better.
Okay.
So a couple possibilities. If you did actually hit the bone, then you may have a little bit of bleeding underneath the skin. There's kind of a surface skin over the bone.
Uh-huh.
And so if you've got a bleeding under that, it'll take a while, like months, to go away completely. More likely, since you were having pain with use of the deltoid muscle, he got the deltoid or the deltoid tendon.
Oh, okay.
And so the tendon is irritated. Tendon irritation is 3 months.
Okay.
Possibly you got a little bruise, deep bruise in the bone. That's also very possible.
I never saw anything
on
the surface.
You wouldn't. If you got a deep hematoma, you wouldn't see it. And again, you're looking at 2 to 3 months for complete resolution. You're improving. It's going to keep improving. So when you should go to the doctor is in February if you've still got trouble.
All right. Can I continue to exercise and do all the stuff I like to do?
Absolutely, and I would ice if it hurts. If it hurts after you exercise, while you're exercising, I'm not so worried. But if it hurts after you exercise, I'd ice it.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And while we're on the subject of vaccines, just a little update on H1N1. Boy, we're having such a little controversy at my own practice about the prevalence data. Really rip-roaring email debate in the practice right now about whether or not the published occurrence data is worth anything. And that has to do with some technical problems with the way the testing is being done and the way the testing is being reported, and whether or not the results of the rapid nasal swab screen are worth anything, how many false negatives there are, how many false positives, and of course, selective testing and a huge delay in getting the DNA results back, which is the gold standard. So ultimately, one of our doctors, a very smart man, thinks that most of the epidemiologic data that's currently being published showing a decline in flu cases is probably inaccurate. Other doctors are still debating about whether or not vaccination should be restricted or be given to all comers, and the distributed justice issues of what do you do when you've only got 90 vaccines. You heard the previous caller say she's not eligible. Well, whether you're eligible or not really varies from office to office. And there's been some pretty absurd things going on with distribution. Many pediatricians' office, the very people you'd expect to be getting the vaccine, haven't gotten the H1N1. And the nearest I can figure is that the reason they haven't gotten it is because they haven't ordered large quantities of flu vaccine in the past, and the priority for distribution has gone to the groups that have ordered lots in the past. But one little good bit of information is that the H1N1 one shot is protecting pregnant women. This is a study looking at antibody levels, and it is showing that pregnant women who receive one shot of H1N1 are showing good rises in antibody titer by 2 weeks out, so a plus. And since pregnant women, especially those in their second and third trimesters, are six times more likely than other healthy adults to develop severe complications, this is a group that we really need to be targeting. One more quick update. Someone has found a cat with H1N1. This was a lady in Idaho who worked at a virus lab, Ohio, whose cat got sick. So she tucked her cat, and sure enough, her cat had H1N1. There have also been two ferrets identified with H1N1. So you can give it to your cat, and probably your cat can give it back. So new and breaking news here on Ask Dr. Dawn. We've got time for just one more caller. Hello, Anonymous in Santa Cruz. You're on the air.
Hi, I have two disparate questions. We'll start with the first one. I had a bone bruise 2 years ago, a skiing accident. I twisted my knee and had a bruise on my tibia and my fibula.
That took about 6 months, right?
Actually, it still hurts.
Ah, long time.
So what do you think? 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
I mean, it showed up on, as a bone bruise, but it was a really bad twist to my knee.
Where does it hurt?
It hurts exactly where the bruises were, where the muscles attach, where the tendons or whatever.
Where is that? Where does it hurt? On your leg?
Okay, right in the inside of my left leg, on the upper, right above my knee and right below my knee.
Okay. Where, all right, so what happened there is, besides the bone bruise, you probably got the medial collateral ligament. That doesn't show up on an X-ray. It would only show up on an MRI.
Okay, so I need to go back to the orthopedic guy.
Because the medial collateral ligament is attached to the meniscus, you may have damaged the medial meniscus. That is by far the most common skiing injury in high intermediate female skiers.
So what would be, not that high, what would be the reason that it still hurts in the bone bruise place, though? Like where the bone was actually bruised?
Because the areas coincide.
Okay.
And the wiring, if you would, for the smoke alarm that we call pain overlaps.
Okay, so, can I have a quick next question?
Yes, you can. But let me just stop you and say you should be checked probably if you're still getting pain at 2 years. You may actually be one of those people who really needs to see an orthopedist and consider surgery, or at least be evaluated for how bad that meniscal injury is. But I'd be very concerned about a meniscal injury. Just before you jump into surgery, let me tell you that the data at 10 years show no difference in arthritis rates for people who have surgery who don't.
Oh, okay. That's what I kind of thought. Yeah, I don't want to jump into surgery, that's for sure.
Okay, go ahead with your other question.
My mom's 86 and was recently diagnosed with breast cancer. She had a partial mastectomy and now is agonizing over radiation. I just don't think she should have even had a mammogram because she's 86. And
does she have any other diseases?
Well, she doesn't take any medications, but she has a goiter because she's a retired nurse.
Right, so she maybe has... At 86, she has a 5-year life expectancy.
Yeah.
The kind of rule that we have is if you're over 85 and you don't have any major life-threatening diseases, you have a 5-year life expectancy. If you're 95 and you don't have any major life-threatening diseases, you have a 5-year life expectancy.
Yeah, right. And her sisters are 90.
Right. So she could potentially live to 105.
Right.
And, you know, you need to look at that and say, okay, in 20 years, that breast cancer could conceivably come back and kill her. I don't
conceivably. It's already been, you know.
Conceivably, yeah. Absolutely. So at 85, she could just say, look, I'm done with aggressive therapy and I'll take my chances. She could also go on one of the SERMs like the tamoxifen or the Evista.
I don't know if it's a receptor.
Yeah, she may not be hormone receptor positive, but there's still some evidence that it's helpful in that group.
Does it have any side effects? She takes no medication. Understand me.
She's not going to have much in the way of side effects. But if she's anti-drug and she's anti-intervention, then it's pretty simple. Don't intervene.
Well, no, she's agonizing over this. So I just wanted to make sure to tell her.
Let me tell you about a study that just got published. Cancer recurs in dense breasts. Here it is. BBC News. You could probably go look on BBC News and find it, just searching dense breasts.
Okay.
This was in the journal Cancer. I don't have a citation because it's a newspaper article, so they don't do that. But it's researchers from Women's College of Toronto. They looked at 333 women who underwent surgery for invasive breast cancer, so worse than what your mom had.
No, hers was categorized as invasive.
Oh, it was. Okay. So in women with dense breasts, the risk of recurrence was very high. This is what you want to hear. 10 years, the difference in the rates of disease recurrence for women who did not receive radiotherapy after surgery was more pronounced, with 40% of women with high-density breasts experiencing cancer recurrence compared with none of the women with the lowest density of breasts.
Mm.
Okay, so interesting information. Let's find out what your mom's breast density is. Let's get a copy of this article, and let's take it into her oncologist and get a comment.
Okay, thank you so much.
Good luck. We got to go.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.